You're listening to the Better for America podcast, presented by AMAC, the Association of Mature American Citizens.
Hello, everyone. I'm Rebecca Weber, and this is your AMAC podcast, Better for America. Today, we're back with the Reb and Rob show. And as always, I'm so grateful to have our own national spokesman, Robert Charles, with us. Bobby has a background that offers AMAC members an unusual window into the world of modern America history, and he's lived so much history, including spending time in the Reagan and Bush 41 White Houses, serving as Assistant Secretary of State under Colin Powell, and running a large part of the Oversight Committee in the U.S. House for 5 years. But Bobby's knowledge is especially fitting for this moment, as he was the one assigned to set up one of America's police training programs in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, Kosovo, Colombia. And so he is steeped in so much knowledge of history, travel, and the law, having been a law clerk, a litigator, House counsel, but also for 10 years, a Navy intelligence officer who incidentally volunteered for active duty on 9/11, a date that we are all thinking about more and more. Notably, while he has held jobs operationally, oversaw strategic policy and legal issues, he also taught government oversight at the Harvard Extension School and has written hundreds of articles and, of course, has penned two great books, Eagles and Evergreens, which highlights the service of World War II veterans, and another book called Narcotics and Terrorism, which links issues front and center in Afghanistan and in that hemisphere. As our nation digs deep to look ahead, we're always so glad to talk with Bobby. Bobby, welcome to the show today.
Thank you so much for that introduction, Rebecca. Important times.
Oh, Bobby, you know, today is a good day, and it's a good day. I was driving into work earlier, and I thought to myself, it's a good day, Bobby, because AMAC was built on such a strong foundation. And that foundation is rooted in faith and our belief in a higher power, our belief in an all-powerful God who knows all of that which we're dealing with. Today in the world that we live in, we feel it feels like a very fast current, right? Events are moving so quickly. And we're seeing that these terrorists are now in control of Afghanistan. And we're coming up on the 20th anniversary of 9/11. We're also witnessing what Congress is doing, spending money that we do not have. And we have a president and a vice president, Bobby. They don't seem to be up to the job. And then we're seeing these big issues before the Supreme Court. So we may not be able to get to all of these issues, but I do want to touch on them all, if we can fit them all in, so that you, Bobby, can help us better understand some of them in the larger context. So let me jump right in and start with Afghanistan, because that is certainly on everyone's mind. Now, Bobby, one thing that I've been reading a lot of and people have been saying is, hey, there have been terrorist attacks going on each and every day in Afghanistan. Why are people making a big deal of it now? And I'm going to have you answer that question, but we here at AMAC, we recognize that the way in which the Biden administration pulled us out of Afghanistan was really a botched effort. It has left Americans and allied Afghans by the thousands behind. And so I'd like for you to please help us, if you could, Bobby, give us a sense of what we know. What do you think should have happened? What didn't happen? And then if you can sort of take us looking forward, what do you think a Taliban-controlled Afghanistan, likely supported by Pakistan, means for the region and for the world? And that sort of brings me back to my initial statement there in Afghanistan, people saying, well, you know, these things, these terror attacks, they've been going on forever and ever. Why is it different now with a Taliban-controlled Afghanistan?
You know, that's such a good and pivotal question, and I think it's something that people need to understand. You know, it's almost like asking before World War One, hey, so this Duke Ferdinand guy got shot in Serbia, what's the big deal? Or in the 1930s saying, hey, there's this guy named Hitler, and he's leading around a few brown shirts and making a mess over there, what's the big deal? The big deal is that in Afghanistan, as in other places in our history and in the history of the world, individual events, how they're treated, how they unfold, actually have the direct effect on second and third and fourth order events downstream that affect all of us. So what should have happened in Afghanistan is that And I think it's important for people to know, over the last 5 years, we've had an average of 10 casualties per year as we have kept relative peace in that country, as we have tried to suppress the Taliban, as we have tried to keep Al-Qaeda and ISIS from getting any foothold in that country and allying with them, keeping, of course, China and Pakistan and others out of there as well. So what we were, you can argue, well, we were over there and it was an extended period. Well, that's true. I mean, after World War II, we spent an extended period in places like Germany and Japan and the Philippines. And South Korea after that. In fact, we're still all there, right? So the point is, you sometimes pay the price in a very low level presence that creates deterrence, that prevents that cascading event where the dominoes begin to fall in a direction that you don't want them to fall in. So with Afghanistan, what we should have done, I mean, having been an assistant secretary with Colin Powell, who executed operations honestly with precision, the military precision that he was known for, you know, he had spent a couple of tours in Vietnam when he was a young man. He knew that mistakes have consequences just as good decisions have consequences. So what should have happened is there should have been an orderly multi-month process for assuring that every civilian that we knew belonged out of that country, including every single American and every single allied Afghan who'd helped us for 20 years. And there were 20,000 that had applied for visas that indicated they had worked for us at least 2 years and for our American military, we should have had all of them out of there. How do you get them out of there? Well, you execute the way Donald Trump executed a year ago and got the evacuees out of countries all over the world for COVID. So what do? You execute on the statute. There's a statute and it says the State Department and that there was a bureau called Crisis and Contingency Response. That bureau should have been immediately, from the beginning of this year, if that's what they were going to do, they should have been starting the process of getting Americans out. And we should have set up a task force so that Americans could register, so we knew who was there and we didn't leave anyone behind. The exact opposite of all those things is what happened. And the peace process, by the way, that Trump had moving was a TikTok process. It was one where if they did one thing, we did one thing. If they did one thing, we did one thing. And they were going to integrate the Afghan government into it so that what you would ultimately have is a fabric of peace. That fabric of peace was rent, torn, obviously, when we pulled out rapidly without planning. What we know about this, Rebecca, is really disheartening in that we know that there was a form called the F-77 in the embassy. It said that there were 15,000 to 40,000 Americans there. So that's 15,000 that we knew and probably families and children. And by the way, dual citizens as well. So obviously we protect our citizens who are dual citizens as well. We also have a system in that embassy called the mascot system, and it tracks people. And that's a voluntary system. If you come into that country, you put your name on that list. It essentially says, we're going to help you. We're going to protect you. We're not going to let something happen to you. We threw all those cards up in the air. The Biden administration abandoned Americans over there, abandoned Afghans over there. We know for a fact there are both Americans and Afghans behind enemy lines. We are hearing right now, literally in real time in this week, that the Biden administration is blocking flights, private flights out of the country because it's a diplomatic, you know, they don't want the diplomatic downstream liability. The bottom line is these people should all have resigned. Mr. Blinken at State made a hash of things. They abolished that CCR Bureau. They did not set up a task force for Americans. They tripped over themselves to get out of that country, running away from this terrorist Taliban organization. Americans don't run. Okay, we have never historically run. And this battle is not over. You can say, well, August 31 came and so Afghanistan's over. No, Afghanistan is not over. We pulled our military out of Afghanistan, but the way it's going right now, as Mr. Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, said the other day, we can look forward to power projection, terrorist activities coming out of that country, possibly within 12 months. So is it over? Yeah. No, it's not over.
And that's the big difference. You know, that's the difference there is what you've just said, that we've got to really brace ourselves. We've got to be smart. We've got to understand the long-term effects here. And it's just mind-blowing that Biden would have abolished the CCR. Or, you know, there doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense there whatsoever. I think American people are seeing that and they're understanding it. Bobby, I want to quickly switch over to 9/11 because this is weighing. I mean, we're just coming up on the 20th anniversary. We all have so many memories of that day. And seeing what's happening in Afghanistan, really, the timing is just terrible, in my personal opinion, because you know, we all have stories. We all know exactly where we were on that fateful day. There are both sad stories and inspiring stories. So, Bobby, you were so close to people who were very pivotal that day. I have a few questions for you tied to 9/11. First, if you could tell us what you saw that day. Second, if you can tell us what you think 9/11 means right now. America is so divided. So I ask you, are we different today on the 20th anniversary than we were on that day in 2001? And then, of course, in terms of threat and America's capacity for unity, if you can please share with me some of your own insight. Now, you were close to one of the F-16 pilots, I think it was, who launched that day. So if you could share a little bit about what you saw, what you felt, what he might have felt, that would be interesting.
Fascinating. And so everything you said, Rebecca, sort of brings it all to the surface again. All of us as Americans remember that day. If you were at a certain age, you will never forget that day, as I'm sure that Pearl Harbor was remembered by a different generation. My own personal story was that I was a naval intelligence officer, and I tended to be, even though I was a reservist, I had volunteered for active duty time fairly regularly in the Pentagon. And by coincidence, no, really by providence, for some reason, that day I was not there in the spaces I was meant to be in. And instead, I was scheduled to give a speech actually to a law enforcement community out in Phoenix, Arizona. And so I boarded a plane. You know, a strange thing I've never said to anybody, but I never worry about anything flying. I've flown 10,000 flights in my life. That particular morning, for some odd reason, when I went in, I thought the word, you know, the idea of a hijacking sort of flittered through my mind, which was odd. I'd never really even thought about that before. And I never thought about it again until after the events of the day. I realized, wow, I thought about that. Why? So I climbed on a plane, left 45 minutes before the one that hit the Pentagon. The bottom line is the pilot came on. We were mid-country. I was asleep. And he said, they didn't tell the pilots what was happening. I'm sure of it. He said, we've just been told to land, and the president has shut down is going to shut down the entire air travel system. So bottom line, as we landed, he told us that what had happened. He said at that point that the two planes had hit the Twin Towers, that the Twin Towers had collapsed. Again, I was in the air for all of that. Grateful that I wasn't on one of those planes, but I landed and immediately got a car headed back toward here. They put us down in Wichita, Kansas, actually. And as these planes came in, it was the strangest thing. It was like elephants, sort of a tail to nose, tail to nose, tail to nose. All these planes coming in, just dozens and dozens of them where I was landing, just stacked up. Just boom, 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 everybody down. My initial thought was that since I know this air traffic control system is triple redundant, my thought was there's just a threat on the system somewhere. There's something, somebody has done something that's, you know, it was not going to be electromagnetic pulse, EMP, because that would have shut down a plane. So China's not going to do that. We're not going to do that. So I got the rental car headed back, and it was at that point that I started to have conversations with my unit. And realized that everybody that was on duty that day wasn't home, wasn't responding. And eventually I interacted with a good friend. Bottom line was, not only was I not there, but, and of course our job, we were the 15, our intelligence job, we were the ones looking out for bad guys. That was part of what we did, our little unit. So they all died in Ring 4. The plane that hit the Pentagon hit Ring 4 and took them out. So that was my life experience there. And this weekend I'll be back over at the Arlington again. And the sadness was enormous. It bound people together, but it also said, hey, God must have preserved you for something. You need to go out and do good and important. You know, anything that you can do, touch the people that you can in a good way. So to your other questions, you know, I think people need to remember that America has been attacked many times in our history, sometimes from within, sometimes from without. And we have always rallied. One of the great characteristics of America is that we are incredibly resilient as individuals, as communities of faith, but also as a nation. And that resilience, to me, is the lasting legacy of 9/11. I will tell you that as I was driving back, again, this was just on the day itself, but I drove deep into the night. It was 23 hours, and I dropped an older lady off in Cincinnati, the world was upside down. The streets, everywhere from Kentucky to wherever, it was empty everywhere. Empty. Nobody out on the roads, with the exception of ambulances. Ambulances silently were going everywhere. And what were they doing? In retrospect, what they were doing is taking blood that people had contributed to airports, where every plane was out of the sky except military planes that were bringing blood to both Washington and to New York. And candles, extraordinary little thing, candles at the sides of the road, American flags over every overpass all across the country, and little groups of people with candles praying at the sides of the road. And one thing I had never seen before, and it's rather remarkable, is every media market I went through. So I'm going through media markets all across the country. Every radio station, including NPR, is announcing prayer meetings in school auditoriums, in churches, in homes. Really quite remarkable.
Isn't that beautiful?
Said to me,
yeah,
we can unify when we need to unify. So the downstream effect of all this is we have to be on guard, especially now with Afghanistan. But we also need to remember that the strength of America is not our government. It is not our political leaders. It is not our institutions or even our economy. It is the fact that we, the people, are an incredibly powerful force for good.
Yes, Bobby, thank you.
We are also, we respond pretty effectively when we have to.
We sure do. And I love that you say it like that. We all need to be reminded. I do think that all of us will have some times of silent reflection in the days ahead. And I know that you will be out to Arlington on Saturday to honor your fallen friends. And we will, as a nation, Bobby, we've got to be praying. We've got to be praying for strength, for unity, for courage, for understanding. We've got to be thoughtful. And we pray for honorable leadership in the future at every level of government. And since we're on the topic of leadership now, let us pause for a moment and just ask, what the heck is this Congress doing when they spend as they are? Bobby, trillions of dollars. Trillions of dollars that we don't have. Yep. So I want to ask you, and for folks that are listening, the next issue of our magazine, we're going to talk about this. We've got some great articles on what's happening here and how serious this problem is of spending. But Bobby, if Democrats in Congress continue to be so reckless with U.S. taxpayer dollars, where does this lead us?
That's the word, by the way, reckless. You couldn't have put a better word on it. That's the exclamation point. Look, we as Americans, we always worry about debt. We all have some, unless you're really effective. You have, very, very few people, whether it's your mortgage or your credit card, people have debt. And we know that part of our job as responsible citizens is to balance our debt. Part of the job of our leaders as responsible leaders is to try very hard not to put the country deeper in debt. So let's look at that question you just asked. We are approaching, there will have to be in September, there will have to be an elevation of what they call the debt ceiling. And I ran the large part of the Oversight Committee for 5 years for House leadership, Gingrich and company. And the bottom line is there's a thing called the debt limit, and it has to be raised if you're going to spend more money. So they have spent so much money that the debt limit will again need to be raised in September. They probably, even though there are Democrats in charge of the House, the Senate, and the White House, they probably will not timely get their budgets done. So there will have to be a continuing resolution. But let's get right to it. We're looking at a nearly $30 trillion national debt. That's almost inconceivable. That's a 30 with 12 zeros behind it.
Unbelievable.
That's a 30 million million. Okay, so what does that mean? When you go out and now spend another $1 trillion on infrastructure, which really ends up being only trivially infrastructure, it's really a lot of other stuff we don't even want, and you get this other bill for things they're calling infrastructure that really aren't infrastructure,
right?
And you've spent yourself into a hole. Then what happens is inflation begins to take off, and we can see that. We're already seeing that at the grocery store. We're seeing it. So as inflation takes off, a number of other things trip forward. What happens is that companies now are getting less for the products they're selling because the value of the dollar has gone down. Mm-hmm. You as a wage earner and I as a wage earner, our dollars are worth less. So we're having to buy things that are at a higher price with money that's worth less than it was yesterday. So that creates kind of a vice, if you will. It creates an environment in which doubt begins to be sown, uncertainty begins to be sown. People realize that the money they have in saving probably needs to be spent today because it'll be worth less tomorrow. People on fixed incomes, pensions, anybody that's on a variable interest rate, those are all going up. Bottom line on all this is that you likely are going to see businesses pull back in response to elevated inflation and excess spending. They're not going to be hiring as rapidly. And we saw that in August. In fact, in August, the economists expected 720,000 jobs. We got 235,000. Okay, so and Biden spun that as good news. You know, only in a world where pulling out of Afghanistan and leaving Americans there would we have a third of the job promotion being described as good news. It's not good news. Okay, so what happens? The end of the day, the hope is that Americans keep their representatives accountable, and that because we individually have to be responsible with our budgets, we ask our leadership to be responsible with the federal budget. Can it be reeled in? Yes. Is it irreversible? No. But is it really frustrating when you have people that don't pay attention to the will of the American people and just do as they wish? Yeah, that's frustrating. And that's where we are right now.
Yeah. And it is so especially concerning to our AMAC members who are largely living on fixed incomes. And can you imagine going to a credit card company where you never pay a bill, you never make the payment on time, or if you're lucky, you're just paying the interest on that bill, and asking your credit card issuer to increase your limit? You know, you gave me $10,000 to borrow. Now I need 20. Now I need 30. Now I need 40. Now I need 50. And people need to understand it's really that simple. I mean, it's a big problem. Sort of the elephant in the room that nobody really wants to talk about. But my goodness, they're talking about spending, spending, spending. And it seems to me that the Democrats are really fixed on creating some sort of federal entitlement state, which would allow more government handouts. And this is certainly not going to be good for the economy. In New York, our unemployment wages just ran out. So I talk to entrepreneurs and business owners all day long, and they're telling me, Rebecca, thank God, we're dying to hire. We've got 10 positions open, 5 positions open. So I think that they've got it all wrong. The Biden administration certainly is not handling our economy in the way in which it should be handled. And they're blaming COVID and blaming, always pointing the finger somewhere else. But it's about time that we elect the people that are going to pay attention. And it's a runaway train the way I see it right now. Something big has got to happen.
Yeah, no, Rebecca, you couldn't have said it better. That's exactly what's happening. It's irresponsible at every level. Mm. And the notion about unemployment benefits, by the way, I would argue that we have an entitlement state already, that we have this state in which people have become dependent on the federal government, and that Democrats think, many of them, the leadership right now, hey, if I can only sort of get you addicted to a little more of this of this national debt, I got you in my pocket for the future, because, by the way, I'm going to give away freebies. Oh, and who are those freebies being paid for? Your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren.
That's right,
we're already spending all their money. We're already spending all their money. Yeah. And by the way, on the unemployment benefits, absolutely right. Labor is right now hard to find because people are being paid by the federal government. They were paid $600 a month more than $300 a month more by the federal government to stay home. So right now, if someone's genuinely unemployed for a real reason, they're going to get the percentage of their income that they would get under the state benefits. But thank God, finally, basically a lot of public pressure said, stop this runaway federal giveaway, because that's money we don't have for people who don't need it.
That's right. Bobby, you were a U.S. Court of Appeals clerk. I want to get to another topic that I think our members are really going to love to hear more about. And you were also a litigator in New York and Washington, D.C., a counsel for the U.S. House Oversight Committee. And so you are familiar with the law, and I know that you follow cases very closely. So if you would, the basic principles you see at work in recent rulings by the U.S. Supreme Court. For example, they effectively struck down Biden's catch and release policies, insisting that Trump's stay in Mexico policy can continue for now. Then they struck down as unconstitutional the Biden White House executive order that extended the eviction moratorium. And then, most interestingly and promisingly, the court let stand the Texas heartbeat law. Now, that Texas heartbeat law keeps the life of a child sacred. It says that no abortion after a heartbeat is heard after roughly 6 weeks. So how do you see these cases? What do they mean individually and collectively about the conservatives on the high court for possible reversal of Roe v. Wade and for congressional action from legislation to court packing? Can you elaborate a little bit on this?
Yes, and you know, what you've done is you've picked the mountaintop out of the mountain range, and that's exactly what we should be looking at. This is a titanic battle, meaning a battle of titans right now between a conservative Supreme Court and a runaway leftist White House and Congress, and they're battling right now. And these three cases that you just mentioned are particularly pivotal. I think they're indicative. I'll discuss quickly all three of them, but they're indicative of something happening in the future, which is that if the Supreme Court is able to hold together, it's at least 5-4, if not occasional 6-3 majority, we're going to see a lot of reversals of things that we've waited 50, 60 years to get reversed. So the first one, the immigration case, absolutely right. So between January and today, the Biden administration has admitted 13,000 illegal aliens under the presumption that their application for asylum allows them to be kind of sit and wait for a year or two out in the American public. What that, and by the way, 70%, actually 71% of all of the asylum applications are denied because there's actually not a well-founded fear of persecution individuated to that person. So what happens? Those people disappear into America and we've got more illegal aliens. What the Supreme Court said is, when Biden came in, he reversed the Trump policy that had been negotiated with Mexico, that they stay in Mexico until it's adjudicated. And if they are, and why is that significant? That's significant because even that is a gimme, honestly. You're supposed to apply under the law from the country where you feel that well-founded fear of persecution. If you're doing that from Guatemala, but you show up in Mexico, you're not being persecuted in Mexico.
Right.
So technically, you don't even need to do that. But we do it anyway. Trump said, we'll do it. You keep them there. We'll look at them. We'll look at them. Bottom line is the Supreme Court said, as you said, Trump policy has to stick. You can't by executive action just sweep it aside. Second big case was the case that Supreme Court decided on the national federal moratorium on evictions. What happens is there was one last year that ran out, and the Supreme Court in June said very expressly, this can only be extended by the legislative act of Congress. It cannot be extended by executive order. Biden's people literally, and Biden himself, you know, the guy's got a hard time getting four words out together. But in any event, he said, I recognize this could be unconstitutional. Okay, well, then don't do it. Well, he did it anyway. In June 30th or July, he signed off on an executive order. So the Supreme Court, fascinating, the Supreme Court wasted no time. They slapped that back right down and said, no way, that's unconstitutional. You know it's unconstitutional, and it's not going to stand. So that's important because, by the way, that's a non-money benefit that's given to people that they stay home, okay? So again, not needed. If it needs to be done, do it at the state level or do it by legislation. The last case, big one, Heartbeat, Texas. So what Texas did that was very unusual that people have not done before is that they passed this law, and maybe other states will do this, saying that not just that if you can hear the heartbeat of a child, which they can at about 160 beats per minute at 6 weeks, if you can hear that heartbeat, you're not allowed to kill that child. Okay. But the way that they changed the law was very clever, not particularly novel, but clever. They said it will be enforced by those, not by the government, but by anybody, including obviously medical or other, that finds that that has happened. So in a sense, they empowered the civil courts to take that statute and enforce it. Now, people have said, oh, that's a terribly wrong thing to do. The liberals say you can't have private enforcement of a public law. Well, time out here. First, what the Supreme Court said was this does not violate the Constitution. Therefore, we're going to let it stand. OK, that's very interesting because it means that at least, and it was a 5-4 decision, at least five of them might be in a position to want to reverse Roe v. Wade right now and say all of those decisions go back to the state level. They don't get held at the federal level. You can't federally find a right in the Constitution that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
But the other interesting part is they say, well, private enforcement is inappropriate. Well, I encourage you to Google private attorneys general or private enforcement of laws. Believe it or not, from the Clean Air Act to everything else, there are 60 federal statutes that are enforced privately. There are probably hundreds and hundreds enforced at the state level privately. So the notion that this is a brand new idea or somehow so novel that it was a workaround, it's not. It's just that they took the enforcement mechanism and they put it in the hands of the people instead of putting it in the hands of government. So long term, I think these three cases indicate that there is a trend line, and the trend says conservatism, as in back to being basically an interpreter of the law and the Constitution, is what the Supreme Court is going to be trying to do. And of course, that really rankles the leftists.
It sure does. And you know, Bobby, the fear that I see on the faces of those from the left when they hear about the heartbeat law is really, it's hard for me to understand. So essentially, and I just want to say this to people listening, what we're talking about here is honoring life. What we're talking about here is recognizing that that those human beings in the womb, developing babies, call them a fetus, call them what you want, but we know scientifically that that is a human being that is alive with a heartbeat. And more as I read, they're determining that there is a these fetuses do feel pain. They can see that. I've read so many. It's heartbreaking to understand how much pain a fetus endures, an unborn child endures due to abortion. So what we're saying here is this bill essentially says no. After 6 weeks, when that heartbeat is beating, it's too late. This is a human being. This is a child. And what I'd love to see happen is for people that, you know, the blind to finally see, people with hardened hearts that really, really believe that abortion is a wonderful thing and that abortion is freedom. It is not. It's destructive. It's death. And I've yet to meet a single woman who has had an abortion who today, after having had an abortion, says, yeah, that was a good decision that I made. I'm okay with it. That's not what, you know, and I interact with many women. Listen, I understand that there is a very personal relationship between an individual and their doctor. And I certainly don't think that any of us should stand in judgment of people who have had to make that tough choice in their lifetime. But I think that as a nation, we need to come together. We need to have some compassion with all of the science and with all of the information that we have today, being able to see that baby on a sonogram, which we couldn't see in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s, even in the 80s. The technology has brought us so far. We can't ignore the fact that this is life. And AMAC is very, very much for life from natural, you know, from conception to natural death. And we will fight to make sure that, you know, every human being has that right, that sacred right to life. So I was thrilled to see what Texas did. I hope that this is indicative of what could happen in the future across other states. But we'll have to see. But it is certainly some good news. And I think the vast majority of our members are with us on this issue. They are for life and protecting the unborn. So, Bobby, I just want to wrap this up. I know that I've got to jump on a plane and you've got another place to be yourself. But one aspect of your life, Bobby, that, you know, that where you've been, I think, so remarkably creative and interesting is the stories that you've collected over the years. And I want to encourage people to read Eagles and Evergreen. Did I say that right? Eagles and Evergreen. Because that book, and I've got it at home, it's an upbeat book. You know, if you like the types of books like Chicken Soup for the Soul, this one is, I say it's even better because this is real life stories of so many people, heroes of our past. So you've collected these wonderful stories, and again, they're upbeat. They're about real leaders and in places that challenged us historically. So maybe as we approach this somber time of our 20th anniversary, 9/11, and we're witnessing this weak leadership, you can offer us a story or two, sort of a counterexample of strong leadership. And maybe also, you just wrote about this, Bobby, the idea of being grateful, especially for our veterans.
Yeah. Yeah, such a great opening there, Rebecca. And I'm actually working on more stories of whom your father is actually a part, in the sense that we have so many great Americans. We have so many great Americans who love this country, and they feel right now, obviously not just 9/11, but bad leadership. They feel frustrated that their voice or their values aren't being heard. And what I learn when I talk to people is that actually we're an amazing country, and that all these people actually are still out there very strong in their personal convictions, and it's the combination of all those that make us who we are, you know. So a few stories, you know, I'll tell you, I did write recently about gratitude and also about you know, how we are looked after, and sometimes we don't even know it. Obviously, my 9/11 story illustrates that. But what I was really thinking about when I wrote the piece, a couple of pieces that are up online, is that, you know, so many Afghan vets, so many Americans who fought in Afghanistan, never mind Iraq and earlier battles and times, often I think in this moment, particularly with bad political leadership, they feel unappreciated. They don't, and the point that, and we have another piece coming out, obviously, in the magazine, the point is that your service to your country based on your convictions is a noble act. No one takes that act away from you. God sees that act. So those we've lost over there, it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking that we've lost Americans from the beginning of the founding of this country. But the reality is that none of that is missed by a loving God. They see that. He sees that. We see that. We see that the heart of the person that goes in, whether they come out unscathed, most don't come out wounded in some way, or come out or don't come out. It's all in God's eyes noble, and it's done for the right reasons. And we've always done that. One story to that effect, also the idea of gratitude, is when I was quite young, I got a job working, teaching swimming at a YMCA in Maine. Of course, I grew up in Maine, and this was in coastal Maine. And, you know, I, being young, I didn't fully appreciate all the blessings around me. I was moving too fast, and I was and so I remember that summer having to get up very early in the morning every morning, and having to work all day, and having the kids, actually young kids of lobstermen, who didn't really appreciate the fact that I was teaching them how to swim. And every day I would walk, I'd say hi to people as I came into the YMCA, but I'd walk by an old gentleman who was always busy. Always busy, always smiling, and always working. He was setting up tables and chairs. He was mopping or sweeping. And it was only at the end of the summer that I realized I hadn't really stopped and talked with him at all. So I took a day, and I can picture him this very minute. And I took a day, and I said, just a few minutes. And I went over. It turns out he had very poor hearing. But he could hear me out of one ear, but it was not good hearing. And some one thing led to another, and the conversation sort of stumbled forward. And the next thing you know, I was asking him about how his hearing ended up. And he said, "Well, I'm a really lucky guy." And I thought to myself, you know, he was probably 70, maybe almost 70 at the time, late 60s. And he thought he was a really lucky guy. And what was he doing? He was doing all the hard work around the YMCA all the time. And he could barely hear. And I said to him, why lucky? He said, "Well," and he had it all. You know, he knew the numbers and the names and the times and the dates. But on June 6, 1944, he was in a landing craft that hit the beach at Omaha Beach in Normandy. And as they hit the beach, didn't even get up on the beach, a German 88, a huge mortar hit the landing craft. And it threw him the distance into the water, up onto the beach. And from that moment forward, he could not hear. He could barely hear. And so I said, "Why lucky?" And he said, "Well, there were 36 men on that boat, and I'm the only one that lived."
Oh boy.
So yeah. Flip that forward. What do we stand for? We stand for doing noble things. We stand for those people that went before us and sacrificed. And we also stand for the future. And that's what Ronald Reagan did. Ronald Reagan spoke bluntly to the Soviet Union. None of this none of this China, you know, indulgence business. He said, you're a communist country. You're repressing millions of people. We stand for the opposite of that. We stand for liberty and equality. And we're going to keep standing for that. And we're going to stand for that long after you and your communist way of thinking is on the dust heap of history, he called it. But the interesting thing about Reagan, just like when he talked about abortion and just like when he talked about the Soviet Union, he did it with a light touch. And so, you know, when you have people who can convey something without giving offense, you listen a little harder. You listen a little closer. And the two stories that come to my mind was, and they're funny stories. He would collect these stories that the Soviet people or the Russian people were telling about their Soviet communist government. And one of those stories was, he said there was a, again, this is really in defense of free speech, but he said there were three dogs. And you'll remember that Eastern Europe was under the thumb also of the Soviet Union. So Poland and Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia and Hungary and so East Germany. And so he said there were three dogs, an American dog, a Polish dog, and a Russian dog. And the American dog said, well, I'm going to, you know, he said, if you bark, they'll bring you meat. And so you need to always remember to bark and they'll bring you a slab of meat. And the Polish dog said, well, what's meat? And the Soviet dog said, the Russian dog said, what's bark? meaning we are so fortunate here to have what we have both materially That's and from right. an ideal perspective. And the other story that comes to my mind is, you know, the Soviets, just like the Chinese, try to pretend they sort of parrot what we do, imagining that they're fooling their people into believing that it's just as good there as here. Well, there is no just as good there as here. Only the United States really and truly has modeled the idea that these Bill of Rights matter. And that's why we can go to court and fight about it. That's why we can publicly yeah. discuss it. And that's why we have to preserve that. But he used to say, again, collecting these stories from the Russian people, that an American once confronted a Russian and said, you know, the difference between our countries is that I can go in. Of course, you got to remember, this is Reagan telling this story. Right. He says, I'm an American and I can go in and I can tell President Reagan, look, I'm just an average American out here, but I don't like the way you're running my country. And he said, there's accountability. And so the Russian said, well, I can do that, too. And the American said, you can? He said, yeah, I can go in to the communist leader, Gorbachev, and I can tell him, I don't like the way President Reagan's running his country. So, you know, Reagan delivered these larger lessons in a quiet, sure happy way. And I think we need to remember, we are actually Americans. We have a great sense of humor. We have a great belief in the future, and people do drag us down, and events do drag us down. But when we unify behind things like liberty and justice and the American way, get out of our way, because no one's going to stop us.
Amen. Thank you, Bobby. Your stories are just so entertaining and upbeat, and that is why I love to end the show with them. And as we look forward, we have a fast current of events to navigate. Bobby, thank you so much. We'll be back again soon with you as events continue to unfold, and knowing leadership will always be so important. So I want to thank you very, very much for your time with us today. And I want to thank all of our AMAC members that are tuning in today. If you haven't downloaded the AMAC News app, you can go ahead and do that right from your smartphone. Just go to your app store and download the News app. You can watch, you can listen to today's podcast, plus track breaking news here. Please make sure, folks, to hit that subscribe button, follow, like, and share wherever you are on social media. Until next time, I'm Rebecca Weber. This is your podcast, Better for America. Thank you so much for being here, and God bless you. Until next time, have a great day, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Better for America podcast. To learn more about AMAC and all it has to offer, visit us at www.amac.us.